I'm Jeffrey Hopkins, the translator and editor of this program. I first heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama teach in 1972, just 3 days after my arrival in Dharamsala in northern India. He started a 16-day lecture series for 4 to 6 hours each day on the stages of the path to enlightenment. I had begun studying Tibetan and practicing Tibetan Buddhism in 1962, and my teachers, particularly gifted in the intricacies of Tibetan commentaries, had prepared me for study with Tibetan refugee scholar yogis in India. But, to be frank, I did not think that a governmentally appointed reincarnation, born in northeastern Tibet in 1935, and recognized through prophecies, visions, extraordinary occurrences, and tests as the 14th Dalai Lama at the age of 2, could possibly live up to the billing. However, I was amazed. He spoke on a wide range of topics concerning the path to enlightenment, capturing my mind and heart with concepts large and small that clarified issues long unresolved. He expanded on others and drew me into new areas of understanding. In Tibetan, the Dalai Lama speaks with such great speed and clarity that it was impossible for me to be distracted. Once, he became particularly inspired while describing the reflections for generating compassion. His voice rose in pitch to a level that he jokingly described as his goat voice, in which I heard the inspired absorption of a poet. During that series of lectures, he presented the full range of practices leading to enlightenment, often juxtaposing topics that others leave in isolation, all this with the depth of a philosopher. The same dual voice of poet and philosopher is present here, sometimes touching the heart with moving descriptions of the condition of life and the beauties of altruism, and at other times making careful distinctions about profound practices like meditation on emptiness, which serve as nourishment for years of contemplation. At the age of 5, the Dalai Lama was brought to Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, where he underwent the full curriculum of monastic training. Due to the communist Chinese invasion of eastern Tibet in 1950, he suddenly had to take the reins of Tibetan government at age 16. Despite attempts to cooperate with the invaders, he was faced with imminent personal danger and escaped to India in 1959. In exile, he has successfully reestablished centers for the broad range of Tibetan culture. He has traveled extensively throughout most of the world, bringing a message, not just to Buddhists and other religious believers, but to everyone, about the importance of kindness to the very fabric of society. In recognition of his untiring efforts on behalf of Tibetans and all peoples, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1989. His Holiness has published many books, some for a general audience and others for those particularly interested in Buddhism. In this program, he draws on a long tradition of spiritual practice in Tibet and on his own experience to offer suggestions on how to practice a spiritual path that will lead to mental clarity and emotional transformation. In this way, he shows how life can be made meaningful. Throughout the 30 years that I have known him, and during the 10 that I served as his chief translator on lecture tours in the United States, Canada, Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, Great Britain, and Switzerland, I have witnessed his embodiment of these practices to the very core of his being. It is important for us to recognize that this insightful, compassionate, humorous and marvelous person rose from Tibetan culture. We need to value that culture as one of the world's great wonders.
From Simon & Schuster Audio, How to Practice, The Way to a Meaningful Life, by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Read by the translator and editor, Dr. Jeffrey Hopkins.
Introduction. The Need for Peace and Kindness. I travel to many places around the world, and whenever I speak to people, I do so with the feeling that I am a member of their own family. Although we may be meeting for the first time, I accept everyone as a friend. In truth, we already know one another, profoundly, as human beings who share the same basic goals. We all seek happiness and do not want suffering. There are two ways to create happiness. The first is external. By obtaining better shelter, better clothes, and better friends, we can find a certain measure of happiness and satisfaction. But the second is through mental development, which yields inner happiness. However, these two approaches are not equally viable. External happiness cannot last long without its counterpart. If something is lacking in your perspective, if something is missing in your heart, then despite the most luxurious surroundings, you cannot be happy. However, if you have peace of mind, you can find happiness even under the most difficult circumstances. Material advancement alone sometimes solves one problem but creates another. For example, certain people may have acquired wealth, a good education, and high social standing, yet happiness eludes them. They take sleeping pills and drink too much alcohol. Something is missing, something still not satisfied, so these people take refuge in drugs or in a bottle. On the other hand, some people who have less money to worry about enjoy more peace. They sleep well at night. Despite being poor in a material sense, they are content and happy. This shows the impact of a good mental attitude. Material development alone will not fully resolve the problem of humanity's suffering. In this program, I offer you, the listener, valuable techniques from Tibetan traditions which, if implemented in daily practice, lead to mental peace. As you calm your mind and your heart, your agitation and worry will naturally subside, and you will enjoy more happiness. Your relationships with others will reflect these changes. As a better human being, you will be a better citizen of your country, and ultimately a better citizen of the world. We are all born helpless. Without a parent's kindness, we could not survive, much less prosper. When children grow up in constant fear, with no one to rely on, they suffer their whole lives. Because the minds of small children are very delicate, their need for kindness is particularly obvious. Adult human beings need kindness too. If someone greets me with a nice smile and expresses a genuinely friendly attitude, I appreciate it very much. Though I might not know that person or understand their language, they instantly gladden my heart. On the other hand, if kindness is lacking, even in someone from my own culture whom I have known for many years, I feel it. Kindness and love, a real sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, these are very precious. They make community possible and thus are crucial in society. Each of us has a valid sense of self, of I. We also share fundamental goals. We want happiness and do not want suffering. Animals and insects also want happiness and do not want suffering. But they have no special ability to consider how to achieve deeper happiness or overcome suffering. As human beings endowed with this power of thought, we have this potential and we must use it. On every level, as individuals and as members of a family, a community, a nation, and a planet, the most mischievous troublemakers we face are anger and egoism. The kind of egoism I refer to here is not just a sense of I, but an exaggerated self-centeredness. No one claims to feel happy while being angry. As long as anger dominates our disposition, there is no possibility of lasting happiness. In order to achieve peace, tranquility, and real friendship, we must minimize anger and cultivate kindness and a warm heart. This can be achieved through the practices I will describe. Developing a warm heart ourselves can also transform others. As we become nicer human beings, our neighbors, friends, parents, spouses, and children experience less anger. They will become more warm-hearted, compassionate, and harmonious. The very atmosphere becomes happier, which promotes good health, perhaps even a longer life. You may be rich, powerful, and well-educated, but without these healthy feelings of kindness and compassion, there will be no peace within yourself, no peace within your family. Even your children suffer. Kindness is essential to mental peace. As you will hear, the central method for achieving a happier life is to train your mind in a daily practice that weakens negative attitudes and strengthens positive ones. The big question is whether or not we can practice kindness and peace. Many of our problems stem from attitudes like putting ourselves first at all costs. I know from my own experience that it is possible to change these attitudes and improve the human mind. Though it is colorless, shapeless, and sometimes weak, the human mind can become stronger than steel. To train the mind, you must exercise the patience and determination it takes to shape that steel. If you practice improving your mind with a strong will and forbearance, by trying, no matter how many difficulties you may encounter at the beginning, then you will succeed. With patience and practice and time, change will come. Do not give up. If you are pessimistic from the beginning, you cannot possibly succeed. If you are hopeful and determined, you will always find some measure of success. Winning the gold medal does not matter. You have tried your best. Much of the world is now connected by a web of electronic communication and instant information. In the 21st century, our global economy has made nations and their people heavily dependent upon one another. In ancient times, trade between nations was not necessary. Today, it is impossible to remain isolated, so if nations do not have mutual respect, problems are bound to arise. Although there are grave signs of trouble between poorer and richer nations and between poorer and richer groups within nations, these economic rifts can be healed by a stronger sense of global interdependence and responsibility. The people of one nation must consider the people of other nations to be like brothers and sisters who deserve progress for their homelands. Despite the best efforts of world leaders, crises keep erupting. Wars kill innocent people. The elderly and our children die continuously, endlessly. Many soldiers who are fighting are not there by their own initiative. Real suffering is experienced by these innocent soldiers, which is very sad. The sale of weapons, thousands and thousands of types of arms and ammunition, by manufacturers in big countries, fuels the violence. But more dangerous than guns or bombs are hatred, lack of compassion, and lack of respect for the rights of others. As long as hatred dwells in the human mind, real peace is impossible. We must do everything we can to stop war and to rid the world of nuclear weapons. When I visited Hiroshima, where the first atomic bomb was dropped, when I saw the actual spot and heard the stories of survivors, my heart was deeply moved. How many people died in a single moment? How many more were injured? How much pain and desolation nuclear war creates. Yet look at how much money is spent on weapons of mass destruction. It is shocking, an immeasurable disgrace. Advancements in science and technology have greatly benefited humankind, but not without a price. While we enjoy the development of jet airplanes, for example, which make it possible to easily travel the world, enormously destructive weapons have also been created. No matter how beautiful or remote their homelands, many people live in constant fear of a very real threat. Thousands upon thousands of nuclear warheads poised for attack. But the button must be pushed by someone, and thus human intention is ultimately responsible. The only way to achieve lasting peace is through mutual trust, respect, love, and kindness. The only way. Attempts by global powers to dominate one another through competition in armaments, whether nuclear, chemical, biological, or conventional, is counterproductive. How can a world full of hatred and anger achieve real peace? External peace is impossible without inner peace. It is noble to work at external solutions, but they cannot be successfully implemented so long as people have hatred and anger in their minds. This is where profound change has to begin. Individually, we have to work to change the basic perspectives on which our feelings depend. We can only do so through training, by engaging in practice with the aim of gradually reorienting the way we perceive ourselves and others. The desperate state of our world calls us to action. Each of us has a responsibility to try to help at the deeper level of our common humanity. Unfortunately, humanity is too often sacrificed in defense of ideology. This is absolutely wrong. Political systems should actually benefit human beings, but, like money, they can control us instead of work for us. If, with a warm heart and patience, we can consider the views of others and exchange ideas in calm discussion, we will find points of agreement. It is our responsibility, out of love and compassion for humankind, to seek harmony among nations, ideologies, cultures, ethnic groups, and economic and political systems. When we truly recognize the oneness of all humankind, our motivation to find peace will grow stronger. In the deepest sense, we are really sisters and brothers, so we must share one another's suffering. Mutual respect, trust, and concern for one another's welfare are our best hope for lasting world peace. Of course, national leaders have a special responsibility in this area, but every individual must also take the initiative, regardless of religious belief. Just by being human, by seeking to gain happiness and avoid suffering, you are a citizen of this planet. We are all responsible for creating a better future. To achieve a friendly attitude, a warm heart, respect for the rights of others and concern for their welfare, you must train the mind. In How to Practice, I will present a series of practices drawn from Tibetan traditions that will be helpful in accomplishing these aims. The essential objective of daily practice is to cultivate an attitude of compassion and calm, a state of mind particularly crucial in human society today for its power to yield true harmony among nations, races, and people from diverse religious, political, and economic systems. The harmony and friendship that we need in our families, nations, and the world can only be achieved through compassion and kindness. By helping one another with concern and respect, we can solve many problems easily. Harmony cannot thrive in a climate of mistrust, cheating, bullying, and mean-spirited competition. Success through intimidation and violence is temporary at best. Its trifling gains only create new problems. This is why just a couple of decades after the enormous human tragedy of the First World War, the Second World War was fought and millions more people were killed. If we examine our long history of hatred and anger, we see the obvious need to find a better way. We can only solve our problems through truly peaceful means. Not just peaceful words, but a peaceful mind and heart. In this way, we will have a better world. Is this possible? Fighting, cheating, and bullying have trapped us in our present situation. Now, we need training in new practices to find a way out. It may seem impractical and idealistic, but we have no alternative to compassion, recognizing human value, and the oneness of humanity. This is the only way to achieve lasting happiness. I travel from country to country with this sense of oneness. I have trained my mind for decades, so when I meet people from different cultures, there are no barriers. I am convinced that despite different cultures and different political and economic systems, we are all basically the same. The more people I meet, the stronger my conviction becomes that the oneness of humanity, founded on understanding and respect, is a realistic and viable basis for our conduct. Wherever I go, this is what I speak about. I believe that the practice of compassion and love, a genuine sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, is the universal religion. It does not matter whether you are Buddhist or Christian, Muslim or Hindu, or whether you practice religion at all. What matters is your feeling of oneness with humankind. Do you agree? Do you think this is nonsense? I am not a God King, as some call me. I am just a Buddhist monk. What I am saying comes from my own practice, which is limited. But I do try to implement these ideas in my daily life, especially when I face problems. Of course, I fail sometimes. Sometimes I get irritated. Occasionally, I use a harsh word. But when I do, immediately I feel, oh, this is wrong. I feel this because I have internalized the practices of compassion and wisdom that form the core of this program. These daily practices are very useful and very valuable in my own life. Therefore, knowing that you and I are of similar mind and heart, I share them with you. When I was only 15, the Chinese communists invaded eastern Tibet. And within a year, the Tibetan government decided that I should direct Tibet's affairs of state. It was a difficult period as we watched our freedoms being eroded. And in 1959, I was forced to escape from the capital under cover of night. In exile in India, we face daily problems, ranging from our need to adjust to the vastly different climate to our need to reestablish cultural institutions. My spiritual practice gave me an outlook that made it possible to keep searching for solutions without losing sight of the fact that we are all humans, led astray by wrong ideas, but united by common bonds, ready for improvement. This has taught me that the perspectives of compassion, calm, and insight are essential to daily life and must be cultivated in daily practice. Trouble is bound to come, so cultivating the right attitude is crucial. Anger diminishes our power to distinguish right from wrong, and this ability is one of the highest human attributes. If it is lost, we are lost. Sometimes it is necessary to respond strongly, but this can be done without anger. Anger is not necessary. It has no value. I call compassion the global staple. Human beings want happiness and do not want suffering. Mental peace is a basic need for all humankind, for politicians, engineers, scientists, homemakers, doctors, teachers, lawyers, for all people in every endeavor, a healthy, compassionate motivation is the foundation of spiritual growth. In How to Practice, I will describe specific Buddhist techniques for gaining mental peace and a greater capacity for compassion within the framework of working to overcome what Buddhists consider to be wrong notions about how beings and things exist. In Buddhist terms, this is the path to enlightenment. However, anyone can make use of particular steps toward self-improvement as they see fit. The program is organized into 6 parts. It begins with the basics, where the story of the Buddha serves as a guide to meaningful living. Here I introduce the 3 aspects of spiritual practice, which are morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. These are the program's principal themes. In the 2nd part, Practicing Morality, I describe 2 types of morality: reorienting physical and verbal deeds so as to cause no harm to others, and cultivating deeper concern for others. In the 3rd part, Practicing Concentrated Meditation, I describe how to achieve mental focus, as well as how to restore calm in stressful situations. This is followed by Practicing Wisdom, which addresses the difficult but fruitful topic of dependent arising and emptiness. Here we go deeper into Buddhist thinking as we consider the difference between the mind and its ultimate nature. By describing the compatibility between appearance and reality, I hope in this 4th part to clear up any notion that Buddhism is somehow nihilistic or pessimistic. These discussions of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom flow into the 5th part, Tantra, which presents a special yoga practice combining these 3. I also discuss here how desire can be used in the spiritual path by competent practitioners. The concluding part, Steps Along the Way, presents an overview of the path of practice from its beginnings right through to enlightenment, a state wherein mind and body are fully developed in order to be of service to others. From beginning to end, our focus is on developing a good heart and mind through a moral attitude and an understanding of reality empowered by concentration. Think of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom as a blueprint for enlightenment, reminding us of the highest aim of practice, a transformation of attitude toward peacefulness, compassion, calm focus, and wisdom. Understanding the blueprint is itself part of the path, drawing us toward the destination. I hope that parts of it may be of use, but if not, that's all right, too. Part 1, The Basics. 3 ways to practice. According to some Buddhist schools, Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddha of this era, first became enlightened in India in the 6th century BC through practice of the path. Others, however, believe that Shakyamuni Buddha had achieved enlightenment long before, and that in his 6th century BC incarnation, he was merely demonstrating the path. In Tibet, we take the latter view, and followers learn from his example how to practice in order to achieve enlightenment themselves. In either case, we need to notice that Shakyamuni Buddha was born into a life of leisure as a prince in an Indian royal family. At age 29, upon seeing the suffering of the world, he gave up his royal position, cut his own hair, left his family, and took on the morality of a monastic, adopting a system of ethical behavior. For the next 6 years, he engaged in ascetic meditation for the sake of achieving concentrated meditation. Then, under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, he practiced special techniques for developing wisdom and achieved enlightenment. He went on to teach for 45 years, and at the age of 81, he died. In the Buddha's life story, we see the three stages of practice. Morality comes first, then concentrated meditation, and then wisdom. And we see that the path takes time. Developing the mind depends upon a great many internal causes and conditions, much like a space station depends on the work of generations of scientists who have analyzed and tested even its smallest components. Neither a space station nor an enlightened mind can be realized in a day. Similarly, spiritual qualities must be constructed through a great variety of ways. However, unlike the space station, which is constructed by many people working together, the mind must be developed by you alone. There is no way for others to do the work and for you to reap the results. Reading someone else's blueprint of mental progress will not transfer its realizations to you. You have to develop them yourself. Cultivating an attitude of compassion and developing wisdom are slow processes. As you gradually internalize techniques for developing morality, concentration of mind, and wisdom, untamed states of mind become less and less frequent. You will need to practice these techniques day by day, year by year. As you transform your mind, you will transform your surroundings. Others will see the benefits of your practice of tolerance and love and will work at bringing these practices into their own lives. Buddha's teachings are divided into three collections of scriptures: the Discipline of Morality, the Discourses on Concentrated Meditation, and the Manifest Knowledge that explains the training in wisdom. In each of these sets of scriptures, the main practice is described as an extraordinary state that is created from the union of calm abiding, which is concentrated meditation, and special insight, which is wisdom. But in order to achieve such a union, first we must lay its foundation, which is morality. Morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. This is the essential order of practice. One reason for this is that in order for the wisdom of special insight to remove impediments to proper understanding and to remove faulty mental states at their very roots, we need concentrated meditation, a state of complete single-mindedness in which all internal distractions have been removed. Otherwise, the mind is too fractured. Without such one-pointed concentrated meditation, wisdom has no force, just as the flame of a candle in a breeze does not give off much illumination. Therefore, concentrated meditation must precede wisdom. Moreover, single-minded meditation involves removing subtle internal distractions, such as the mind's being either too relaxed or too tight. To do so, we must first stop external distractions through training in the morality of maintaining mindfulness and conscientiousness with regard to physical and verbal activities, being constantly aware of what you're doing with your body and your speech. Without overcoming these obvious distractions, it is impossible to overcome subtler internal distractions. Since it is through sustaining mindfulness that you achieve a calm abiding of the mind, the practice of morality must precede the practice of concentrated meditation. In my own experience, taking the vows of a monk called for fewer external involvements and activities, which meant that I could focus more on spiritual studies. Vows to restrain counterproductive physical and verbal activities made me mindful of my behavior and drew me to inspect what was happening in my mind. This meant that even when I was not purposely practicing concentrated meditation, I had to control my mind from being scattered and thus was constantly drawn in the direction of one-pointed internal meditation. The vow of morality has acted as a foundation. Looking at the three practices, morality, concentrated meditation and wisdom, we see that each serves as the basis for the next. This order of practice is clearly demonstrated in the Buddha's own life story. Therefore, all spiritual progress depends on a foundation of proper morality. Part 2. Practicing Morality. Identifying the scope of suffering. The main principle of Buddhist morality is to help others and, if that is not possible, at least to do no harm. This fundamental commitment to nonviolence, motivated by concern for others, is central to the three types of morality in Buddhism. First, the morality of individual liberation. Second, the morality of concern for others. And third, the morality of Tantra. The morality of individual liberation is mainly practiced by refraining from physical and verbal actions that cause harm to others. This practice is called individual because it provides a way for a person to prepare to move beyond the repeated round of birth, aging, sickness, and death, which Buddhists call cyclic existence or samsara. The morality of concern for others, called the morality of bodhisattvas, who are beings primarily concerned with helping others, is mainly practiced by restraining the mind from falling into selfishness. For those practicing bodhisattva morality, the essential point is to refrain from self-cherishing, but also to refrain from ill deeds of body and speech. The morality of Tantra centers around special techniques for imagining a fully developed state of body and mind, effectively helping others. It provides a way to restrain and thus transcend our limited perception of our bodies and minds so that we may perceive ourselves shining with wisdom and compassion. Let's first consider the morality of individual liberation. This type of morality requires the self-awareness needed to refrain from physical and verbal actions that bring harm to others. This means abandoning what Buddhists call the 10 non-virtues. These are organized into three categories. The physical non-virtues are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. The verbal non-virtues are lying, divisive talk, harsh speech, and senseless chatter. The mental non-virtues are covetousness, harmful intent, and wrong views. Since motivation precedes and drives actions, controlling it is the best way to prevent impulsive and possibly abusive physical and verbal actions. When you suddenly want something and just reach out and take it without considering the consequences, your desire is expressing itself impulsively, without benefit of reflection. In daily practice, you learn to continually examine your motivation. When I was a boy, Ling Rinpoche, who was then my junior tutor, was always very stern. He never smiled, not even a little. This bothered me a lot. By wondering why he was so humorless, I examined more and more what I was doing in my own mind. This helped me develop self-awareness with regard to my motivation. By my early 20s, when I had matured, Ling Rinpoche completely changed. He always had a big smile when we were together. Effective practice of the morality of individual liberation depends upon sound long-term motivation. For example, one should not become a monk or a nun to avoid having to work at a worldly job for food and clothing. Also, it is not sufficient merely to seek to avoid difficulty in this lifetime. To be motivated by such trifling purposes does not help to achieve freedom from cyclic existence, the ultimate reason to practice the morality of individual liberation. This is confirmed by Buddha's life story. One day, Shakyamuni slipped outside the palace wall to examine life for himself. For the first time, he saw a sick person an old person, and a corpse. Deeply troubled by the suffering of sickness, aging, and death, he came to the conclusion that worldly life is without substance. Later, inspired by several religious practitioners, Buddha became captivated by the possibility of a higher, more meaningful spiritual life. At that point, he escaped from the palace, leaving his ordinary life behind to pursue that vision. What does this teach us? Like Buddha, we need to begin by becoming concerned about the suffering of cyclic existence and by turning away from temporary distractions. Influenced by this new attitude, we must take up a system of morality by renouncing cyclic existence and by taking vows of pure behavior through seeking to avoid the 10 non-virtues. In order to free ourselves from cyclic existence, we need to understand its nature. We need, 1, to know the specific types of suffering involved. 2, to discover the causes of those sufferings. 3, to see if it is possible to remove those causes. And then 4, to determine what should be practiced. Renunciation, therefore, involves at least partial understanding of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are 1. True suffering. 2. True sources of suffering. 3. True cessations of suffering and its sources. And 4. True paths for actualizing true cessations. When Buddha began teaching for the first time, he taught the Four Noble Truths in the order just given. However, this order does not reflect how these truths come into being. In temporal sequence, the second truth, the sources of suffering, precedes the first truth, suffering itself. Similarly, the fourth truth, the paths of practice, must precede attainment of the third, the cessations of suffering. However, Buddha taught the four truths in the order of practice, not in the order in which they are produced. In practice, you have to identify the extent of suffering first to know that this type of life is beset by misery. This deepens your natural wish to be freed from pain. When you have to recognize suffering for what it is, as Buddha did, then you will be drawn into discovering its causes, the sources of suffering. Just as a doctor must first diagnose a disease, you must understand the root cause of suffering before you can treat it. Not until you have determined the sources of suffering can you understand that there could be a cessation to it. Also, without decisively understanding that the end of suffering is possible, you might consider practice of this path just a fruitless hardship. Then you can seek the true paths for actualizing true cessations. This is why Buddha presented the four truths in the given order of practice. Suffering is the first noble truth. Suffering is like a disease we have all contracted. To find the cure, we must carefully identify the full scope of the disease. There are three types: pain, change, and pervasive conditioning. The first type of suffering is out-and-out pain that we all recognize as such. Even animals want to overcome it. The physical and mental pains of daily life, like headaches and the anguish of separation, fall into this category. The second type of suffering is the suffering of change. What we usually experience as pleasure is mostly a diminishment of pain. If good food or drink, for example, really were just pleasurable, if they had an inner nature of pleasure, then no matter how much we ate or drank, we would feel greater and greater happiness in equal measure. Instead, if we partake excessively, we begin to suffer in our bodies and in our minds. This indicates that these experiences of pleasure have an inner nature of pain. I like to tell the story of a family that buys a new television. Compared to the old one, it is really great, and everyone watches it for days on end, but eventually they get tired of it. This indicates that the original pleasure has a nature of pain. Such states of temporary happiness are called the suffering of change. The third type of suffering is called pervasive conditioning. It is deeper than ordinary pain and the suffering of change. Mind and body operate under the influence of karma, karma being tendencies created by previous actions. And mind and body also operate under the influence of afflictive or counterproductive emotions such as lust and hatred. In ordinary life, we are born from and into the pervasive influence of karma and afflictive emotions. Even neutral states of feeling are under the influence of causes and conditions beyond your control. You are stuck in a process susceptible to suffering. At the beginning of our life is birth, during which we suffer. And at the end of our life is death, during which we also suffer. Between these two come aging and illness. No matter how wealthy you are or how physically fit you are, you have to suffer through these circumstances. On top of this comes discontentment. You want more and more and more. This, in a sense, is real poverty. Always to be hungry, 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 with no time to be satisfied. Others might not be rich, but contentment provides them with fewer worries, fewer enemies, fewer problems, and very good sleep. On more than one occasion, when I have visited very nice homes in rich communities, I have peeked inside the medicine chest in the bathroom and found some medications to provide energy for the day and yet others to induce sleep at night. Contentment might do both of these jobs better, since it reduces anxiety during the day, paving the way for sleeping peacefully. In the frenzy of modern life, we lose sight of the real values of humanity. People become the sum total of what they produce. Human beings act like machines, whose function is to make money. This is absolutely wrong. The purpose of making money is the happiness of humankind, not the other way around. Humans are not for money. Money is for humans. We need enough to live, so money is necessary. But we also need to realize that if there is too much attachment to wealth, it does not help at all. As the saints of India and Tibet tell us, the wealthier one becomes, the more suffering one endures. Even friends can bring suffering. Usually we feel that friends bring us more pleasure and happiness, but sometimes they bring more trouble. Today your friend has a nice smiling face, but in a moment the conversation can turn sour and you start to fight with no trace of friendship. We do gain happiness and satisfaction from our friends, but it is impermanent. It is not true happiness. Therefore, in a deep sense, ordinary friendship also has a nature of pain. Look at your own body. No matter how smooth your complexion and how fine your figure, if you shed even one drop of blood, it is suddenly not so good looking. Under the skin there is raw flesh. Look deeper and you find bone. Skeletons in a museum or a hospital make most of us uncomfortable, but we are all the same underneath. Some people may be quite fat, others thin, some handsome. Yet if I look at them with an X-ray machine, I see a room full of skeletons with huge eye sockets. Such is the real nature of our body. Consider the pleasure of eating. Today I had some delicious food. Before I ate it, it was beautiful. But as it passed through my stomach and intestines, it changed into something not so beautiful. When eating, we avoid noticing that this happens, and we take pleasure, thinking, "Oh, now this is a very good meal. I am really pleased." but that beautiful food gradually passes through my body and finally goes into the toilet in a form nobody regards as beautiful. This stuff that people regard as very dirty actually is made in this human body. If I may make a joke, it sometimes seems that making stool is a principal function of our bodies. Eating, working, and making money are meaningless in themselves. However, even a small act of compassion grants meaning and purpose to our lives. Analyze, think. When you do, you will recognize that our ordinary way of life is almost meaningless. But do not become discouraged. It would be very foolish to give up now. On those occasions when you feel most hopeless, you must make a powerful effort. We are so accustomed to faulty states of mind that it is difficult to change with just a little practice. Just a drop of something sweet cannot change a taste that is powerfully bitter. We must persist in the face of failure. In difficult personal circumstances, the best recourse is to try to remain as honest and sincere as possible. Otherwise, by responding harshly or selfishly, you simply make matters worse. This is especially apparent in painful family situations. You should realize that difficult present circumstances are entirely due to your own past undisciplined actions. So, when you experience a difficult period, do your best to avoid behavior that will add to your burden later on. It is important to diminish undisciplined states of mind, but it is even more important to meet adversity with a positive attitude. Keep this in mind. By greeting trouble with optimism and hope, you are undermining worse troubles down the line. Even beyond that, imagine that you are easing the burden of everyone suffering problems of that kind by your undergoing this problem. This practice, imagining that by accepting your pain, you are using up the negative karma of everyone destined to feel such pain, is very helpful. Sometimes when I am sick, I practice taking others' suffering to myself and giving them my potential for happiness. This provides a good deal of mental relief. Every day in the early morning, and especially when I have the time, I do this practice in a general way with regard to all living beings. But, in particular, I single out Chinese leaders and those officials who must make decisions on the spot to torture or kill particular Tibetans. I visualize those leaders and draw their ignorance, prejudice, hatred, and pride into myself. I feel that, because of my own training, even if in reality I could absorb some portion of their negative attitudes, it could not influence my behavior and turn me into a negative person. Therefore, ingesting their negativities is not that much of a problem for me, but it lessens their problems. I do this with such strong feeling that if later in the day in my office I hear of such atrocities, although one part of my mind is a little irritated and angry, the main part is still under the influence of the morning practice. The intensity of the hatred is reduced to the point where it is groundless. Whether this meditation really helps those officials or not, it gives me peace of mind. Then I can be more effective. The benefit is immense. Under no circumstances should you lose hope. Hopelessness is a real cause of failure. Remember, you can overcome any problem. Be calm, even when the external environment is confused or complicated. It will have little effect if your mind is at peace. On the other hand, if your mind gives way to anger, then even when the world is peaceful and comfortable, peace of mind will elude you. Here for your daily practice is how to identify the scope of suffering. 1. Examine your motivation as often as you can. Even before getting out of bed in the morning, establish a nonviolent, non-abusive outlook for your day. At night, examine what you did during the day. 2. Notice how much suffering there is in your own life. There is physical and mental pain from sickness, aging, and death, which you naturally seek to avoid. There are temporary experiences, like eating good food, that seem to be pleasurable in and of themselves, but, if indulged continuously, turn into pain. This is the suffering of change. When a situation switches from pleasure to pain, reflect on the fact that the deeper nature of the original pleasure reveals itself. Attachment to such superficial pleasures will only bring more pain. Reflect on how you are caught in a pervasive process of conditioning that, rather than being under your own control, is under the influence of karma and afflictive emotions. 3. Gradually develop a deeper, more realistic view of the body by considering its constituents, skin, blood, flesh, bone, and so forth. 4. Analyze your life closely. If you do, you will eventually find it difficult to misuse your life by becoming an automaton or by seeking money as the path to happiness. 5. Adopt a positive attitude in the face of difficulty. Imagine that by undergoing a difficult situation with patience, you are also preventing worse consequences from karmas that you would otherwise have to experience in the future. Take upon yourself the burden of everyone's suffering of that type. 6. Regularly evaluate the possible negative and positive effects of feelings such as lust, anger, jealousy, and hatred. When it becomes obvious that their effects are very harmful, continue your analysis. Gradually, your conviction will strengthen. Repeated reflection on the disadvantages of anger, for example, will cause you to realize that anger is senseless. This decision will cause your anger to diminish gradually. Discovering how trouble starts and stops. The second noble truth is sources of suffering. After identifying the scope of suffering, we need to discover its sources, which are twofold: afflictive or counterproductive emotions and contaminated karmas. Since afflictive emotions are what contaminate karmas or actions, I will discuss afflictive emotions first. There are two classes of afflictive emotions, one that is better expressed and the other that is better not expressed. An example of the type that is better to express is a terrible fear from the past that has become fixed in the mind. In this case, it is definitely beneficial to let your feelings out and discuss the incident. When I was around 14 years old, during the summer at the Norberlinger Palace, the regent, who at that time was my senior tutor, scolded me after a teaching that he gave annually. With a harsh demeanor, he said, "Even if your realization is equal to a god's, your behavior still has to conform to a human being's." I was hurt because I felt that I was already acting as an ordinary student, listening to him, even though I was the Dalai Lama, ranking above him. I was irritated and remained uncomfortable for the next few months. Then the Chinese communists invaded eastern Tibet in 1950, and I had to escape from Lhasa to Tromo in southwestern Tibet near the Indian border. In time, officials in Lhasa advised me that the situation looked workable and that I should return. While on the way back to Lhasa, we spent several days at the regent's monastery, Dalungtra. One day he asked during a casual chat, whether because of his attitude I ever had become upset. I mentioned what had happened, somewhat vaguely, without much detail. What a relief this was! We went on to have a pleasant stay at the monastery. It is better to talk about such things that occur only once, whereas the other class of counterproductive emotions, which include such feelings as lust, hatred, enmity, jealousy, or belligerence, should not be expressed. They become more and more frequent if they are. Expressing them tends to make them stronger and more prevalent. It is better to reflect on the disadvantages of engaging in such emotions and to try to displace them with feelings of satisfaction and love. We should forcefully overcome negative emotions when they appear, but it would be even better to find ways to prevent them in the first place. Lust and hatred give rise to other counterproductive emotions, and thereby create a whole lot of trouble in this world. We cannot be content to live with the consequences of lust and hatred. Of the two, hatred is worse on an immediate basis because it so quickly brings harm to others. But lust is responsible for driving on the whole process of cyclic existence, the repeated round of birth, aging, sickness, and death from lifetime to lifetime. The root of lust and hatred is ignorance of the true nature of all living beings, as well as ignorance of the nature of inanimate things. This ignorance is not just lack of knowledge, but a consciousness that imagines the exact opposite of the truth. It misapprehends what is actually so. There are many levels of misperception, as in failing to understand what to adopt and practice and what to discard in daily behavior. But here we are talking about the ignorance at the root of all suffering. This is the notion that sentient beings and other phenomena exist inherently, exist in and of themselves. I will discuss this difficult topic later. All pleasure and pain depend on karmas, or former actions that have created predispositions in the mind. Karmas can be divided into virtuous and non-virtuous, according to whether they produce pleasure or pain in the long run. For instance, if the effect of an action is to establish a new human life, then that action is virtuous, because its long-term effect is a good transmigration. Conversely, if the effect of an action is to cause your rebirth as a hungry ghost, then that action is non-virtuous, because its long-term effect is a bad transmigration. Karmas can also be divided into those that etch the general outline of a new lifetime by determining the type of birth as well as the length of life, and those that fill in the details of a lifetime, such as prosperity, good health, and so on. The former type is called a path of action, because that action, whether virtuous or not, serves as a path or a means to a complete lifetime in either a happy transmigration or a bad transmigration. To be a path of action, a karma must have four characteristics: motivating intention, correct identification of the person or object, proper preparation, and successful completion. Sometimes all of these factors occur, as in the case where you intend to give to a beggar and actually do so. Sometimes only the motivation is present, and you intend to give to a beggar but do not actually do so. Or you may get the result unintentionally. If some money drops through a hole in your pocket onto the sidewalk, and a beggar picks it up. Actions that do not have all four characteristics could fall into the second category, which fills in the details of a lifetime. Finally, karmas can be divided into those performed by groups, such as organized charities or nations, and those undertaken individually. The effects of karmas can be experienced in the same life, in the next life, or in a life after that. Strong virtuous or non-virtuous karmas with a powerful motivation to help or to harm can yield their effects during the same life. In order to understand the types of karma and the special features of the highest levels of practice, we need to understand the dynamics of three stages: the process of death, the intermediate state between this lifetime and the next, and the process of rebirth out of the intermediate state. The transmission of karmas from one lifetime to another occurs at death through a very subtle mind of clear light. Although this deepest level of mind exists throughout life, it is manifest at death, and therefore is often taught in this context. This topic is discussed in many texts of Highest Yoga Tantra, which were spoken by Buddha, such as the Guhya Samaja Tantra. These texts describe the many different categories of mind or consciousness, ranging from gross to subtle. Subtler states of mind are more powerful and effective when applied in spiritual practice. The grossest level of consciousness perceives through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body. More subtle is mental consciousness, which itself ranges from gross levels, such as ordinary thought, to deep sleep and fainting when the breath has stopped, to the innermost subtle mind of clear light. Except in extraordinary meditative states, the subtlest or deepest consciousness manifests itself only when we are dying. Less withdrawn and therefore brief versions of the subtle levels of consciousness also occur when going to sleep, ending a dream, sneezing, yawning, and during orgasm. I will discuss the last of these later. The process of dying involves a serial cessation or dissolution of the four internal elements: earth, which is the hard substance of the body, water, which is its fluids, fire, which is the body's heat, and wind, which is energy or movement. In ordinary life, these elements serve as the basis for consciousness, but during the process of dying, their capacity to support consciousness decreases, beginning with the earth element. Each step in this dissolution actually increases the capacity of the next element to support consciousness. Step by step, it looks like this. 1. When the earth element, or hard substances of your body, dissolves into the water element, the external indication is that your body becomes thinner. Internally, you see what appears to be a mirage scene in a desert. 2. When the water element of your body dissolves into the fire element, the external signs are that the fluids in your body dry. Your mouth dries, your nose puckers, and so forth. Internally, you see what has been described as puffs of smoke from a chimney, or smoke floating throughout a room. 3. When the fire element of your body dissolves into the wind or air element, the external indication is that the heat in your body diminishes. Internally, you see what look like fireflies at night or like scattering sparks. Heat withdraws from the body in various ways, from the feet upward to the heart or from the top of the head down. The former is preferable, because it indicates that the mind will exit the body either upward or straight forward, not downward, and thus will most likely lead to a favorable next lifetime. This is caused by virtuous karma. 4. The wind, or movement of energy in your body, dissolves into consciousness, and your outer breath, your usual breath, ceases. At this time, you see an appearance like the light above a flickering candle flame when the fuel has almost been used up. Some doctors would consider a person in this state to be dead, but from the Buddhist point of view, the mere cessation of the usual outer breath does not mean that consciousness has left the body. Then the flickering light is followed by the appearance of a steady flame. Following that, the final four phases of dying involve the dissolution of grosser levels of consciousness into subtler. This happens when the winds or inner energies that serves as the mounts of consciousness dissolve. Think of consciousness as mounted on energy, like a rider on a horse. In preparation for the next phase, the energies that served as the mounts of the many types of conceptual consciousnesses dissolve, shifting the basis of consciousness from grosser to subtler levels of energy. These naturally occur in four phases which follow the ones I just gave. Number 5. Your mind itself turns into an omnipresent, huge, vivid, white vastness. It is described as a clear sky filled with moonlight. Not the moon shining in empty space, but that space filled with white light. Conceptual thought has vanished, and nothing appears except this vivid whiteness, which is your consciousness. However, a subtle sense of subject and object remains, so the state is slightly dualistic. 6. Your mind turns into a red or orange vastness, more vivid than before. Nothing else appears. It is like a clear sky filled with sunlight. Not the sun shining in the sky, but space itself filled with red or orange light. In this state, the mind is even less dualistic. 7. Your mind itself turns into a still more subtle, vividly black state. Nothing else appears. This is called near attainment because you are close to manifesting the mind of clear light. The mind of black vastness is like a moonless, very dark sky just after dusk when no stars are seen. In the beginning of this phase, you are aware, but then you lose awareness as you slip into even thicker darkness. 8. When the mind of black appearance ceases, your mind itself turns into the fully aware mind of clear light. Called the fundamental innate mind of clear light, this is the most subtle, profound, and powerful level of consciousness. It is like the sky's natural state at dawn, not sunrise, without moonlight, sunlight, or darkness. The passage through to the mind of clear light can be fast or slow. Some people remain in the final stage, the mind of clear light of death, for only several minutes. Others stay for as long as a week or two. Since the mind of clear light is so powerful, it is valuable to practice. Therefore, many Tibetan practitioners rehearse these stages of dying on a daily basis. I myself practice them 6 times daily by imagining the 8 levels of mind one by one without, of course, the physical changes in the first 4 stages. The 8 levels of mind are mirage, smoke, fireflies, flame of a candle, vivid white sky mind, vivid red or orange sky mind, vivid black sky mind, and clear light. In the process of dying, we know that the person is still in the clear light as long as the body does not begin to smell or rot. There are Tibetans who have been tortured and, upon being returned to their jail cells, sit cross-legged in the process of death, sustaining the mind of clear light. Reportedly, their Chinese communist prison guards have been amazed by this. From the viewpoint of their own dogmatism, they regard Buddhism as blind faith. So when they are faced with such evidence, they try to keep quiet about it. In India, too, quite a number of practitioners have remained in this state, sometimes for a few days, and in one case for around 17 days. When a person is abiding in the state of clear light, if the energy that supports this deep level of mind begins to fluctuate. At that point, consciousness finally leaves the body, and the body or head shifts slightly. There are many opportunities for further investigation into the stages of death. Modern science has done a great deal of research on energy waves, the human brain, and its functions. Scientists and Buddhists share a common interest in this area, and I believe we should work together to probe the relationship between the mind and its inner energies and between the brain and consciousness. Buddhist explanations can contribute to scientific research and vice versa. This kind of cooperation is already underway, and more would be helpful. All beings who are to be reborn as humans pass through an intermediate state between this lifetime and the next. In this intermediate state, your body takes on a shape that resembles your body in the next life at age 5 or 6. However, some say that this is not necessarily so. When the intermediate life ends, the bridge to the next lifetime has been crossed. This process is carried out by the subtlest level of mind. With regard to rebirth, consciousness enters the womb when the male and female fertilizing elements mix together. This is provided there is nothing wrong in the womb or with the sperm, and provided all the favorable factors such as karmic connection are present. However, consciousness does not necessarily have to enter at the time when the male and female are in union. For even in our own texts, there are accounts of the father's semen being inserted into the vagina separately from intercourse. It seems that whether these elements come together inside or, as sometimes is the case nowadays, outside the womb in vitro, consciousness would have to enter while they mix. Still, it is difficult to arrive at a decisive explanation from Buddhist texts, since some books say that fertilization takes place when male and female are at a point of strong desire. This complex subject becomes more complicated in modern times. Consider an instance when an embryo is refrigerated. Once the connection has been made from the past life to the new life through fertilization, would that being whose embryonic body is refrigerated undergo the suffering of cold? The very beginning of the body has already been established. And so, according to our explanations, the organ of bodily feeling has already primitively formed, even though the organs of vision and so forth have not. Is there physical sensation from the next moment after fertilization? I have not come to a decision on these points. They are topics for much discussion. If we assume that the being in the embryo does suffer cold, this raises the question of whether the person who puts the embryo in the refrigerator accumulates bad karma from that action. This would depend on the person's motivation. We cannot say that just because another being undergoes suffering due to something that is somehow involved with you, you would accumulate bad karma. For instance, even in normal circumstances, a fetus in the mother's womb undergoes suffering due to being in the womb. But the mother does not accumulate any bad karma. Similarly, when the child is born, it suffers again, but the mother does not accumulate any bad karma. If she did, a mother who gave birth to many children would have accumulated a great deal of bad karma, which is absurd. Therefore, a person's motivation is the key to determine what type of karma accumulates. The third noble truth is that of true cessations. Since defilements of the mind, such as lust, hatred, jealousy, and belligerence, are based on a fundamental misconception of the nature of persons and objects, the process of overcoming them requires a solution to that ignorance. The question becomes how to uproot the ignorance that is the cause of suffering. It cannot be pulled out like a thorn or removed through surgery. In order to overcome this misconception of the nature of persons and things, you have to understand their true nature. Then, through continued meditation, you become accustomed to the truth and increase the power of wisdom to undermine negative emotions rooted in ignorance. At this point, an explanation of emptiness would be helpful, since this is what wisdom realizes about the nature of persons and things, but this will be discussed later. In brief, the fact that defilements such as afflictive emotions can be extinguished at all is due to the mind not being impure by nature. The mind has a pure essence. Defilements are purified through meditation on the true nature, both of the mind and of all other things. Extinguishing these defilements is the third noble truth of cessation, a state beyond suffering and its causes. The fourth noble truth is true paths. True paths refer to three ways of training that are the principal topics of this program: morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. Spiritual practice along these paths leads to true cessations, culminating in nirvana and eventually Buddhahood. From beginningless time, we have had a valid awareness or consciousness of I. This I, or self, naturally and innately wants happiness and does not want suffering. And this desire is valid. It is true. It is reasonable. Consequently, all of us have the right to achieve happiness and banish suffering. The fact that suffering and happiness themselves change from moment to moment indicates that these experiences depend upon causes and conditions. In order to get rid of suffering, we need to eliminate the causes and conditions of suffering. And in order to achieve happiness, we need to acquire the causes and conditions of happiness. The first two noble truths apply to the impure phenomena which we want to get rid of, these being true sufferings, which are the effects, and true sources, which are the causes. The final two noble truths are pure states which we want to attain, these being true cessations, which are the effects, and true paths, which are the causes. The way Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, they contain two sequences, one of suffering, which we seek to abandon, and one of happiness, which we seek to adopt. Summary for daily practice. Remember this. Having recognized the scope of suffering, research its causes or sources, and identify that the source of suffering is ignorance of the true nature of persons and things, which results in lust, hatred, and so forth. Realize that suffering can be removed. It can be extinguished into the sphere of reality. Reflect that this true cessation is attained through the practice of morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom, the true paths. Refraining from harm. Buddhists take a vow of morality in the context of first taking refuge in Buddha, in the states of realization, and in the spiritual community. Refuge is the foundation for the practice of morality. Buddha teaches us how to find refuge from suffering and limitation. But the chief refuge or source of protection is found in the states of realization achieved through practicing morality, concentrated meditation, and wisdom. Buddhist scriptures recommend that you hide your good qualities and achievements like a lamp inside a vessel. You should not advertise them unless there is great purpose in doing so. It is considered a minor infraction of a monastic's vow if he or she achieves the state of liberation and says to someone else, "I have attained liberation." This being the case, it is difficult to determine what stage of inner experience another person has achieved. I have had the opportunity to meet several people who have attained extraordinary spiritual development. There was a not very scholarly monk from my Namgyal monastery who came out of Tibet to India around 1980. Since we knew each other, we were casually chatting one day. He told me that while he was in a Chinese communist gulag for almost 18 years, he faced danger on a few occasions. I thought he was referring to a threat to his own life. But when I asked, "What danger?" he answered, "Losing compassion toward the Chinese." He considered this to be the danger. Most of us would feel proud to tell others about how angry we got, as if we were some kind of hero. Another Lama, who was from the Drukpa Gagyu tradition, and I were very close. We met frequently and always used to joke, teasing each other back and forth. On one occasion, I asked him about his spiritual experience. He told me that when he was young, he was staying with his Lama, who had him perform the preliminary practice of making 100,000 prostrations to the Buddha, the doctrine, and the spiritual community. Early in the morning and late in the evening, he had to make prostrations on a low platform the length of his body. His Lama was meditating in the dark in the next room, so to trick him into thinking he was making prostrations, he would tap with his knuckles on the prostration platform. Years later, after his Lama passed away, he was taking a meditation retreat in a cave, during which he recalled his Lama's great kindness over years of training him, and he wept and wept. He almost fainted, but then experienced the clear light, which he kept continuously practicing. Subsequently, after successful meditations, he occasionally would remember past lives in vivid reflections before him. These first-hand stories have inspired me. There are definitely practitioners today moving in the direction of Buddhahood. Meeting these people increases our inspiration and determination, and through them, the teaching becomes alive. In this way, the spiritual community provides models for practitioners to look up to, which can lead us to refuge. These three, the Buddha, the states of realization and doctrines that teach them, and the spiritual community, are factors outside yourself that have greater capacity to end suffering than you presently do. However, a Buddhist is not asking them to grant happiness. Rather, happiness comes from putting the doctrine into practice. Buddha teaches the actual refuge, how to practice the doctrine, but the main responsibility lies in your own implementation. To create the foundation for an eventual spiritual state devoid of suffering and limitation, we need to engage in the following practice. 1. Identify the 10 non-virtues. 2. Identify the 10 virtues, which are the opposites of those non-virtues. And 3, abandon the 10 non-virtues and adopt the 10 virtues. Because people vary in their ability to keep certain vows, Buddha described several levels of moral practice. Within the morality of individual liberation, there are those who live a householder's life, in a home rather than a monastery, and those who have left a householder's life to become nuns or monks. If you are capable of maintaining chastity for a lifetime, you can leave the household and take monastic vows. If you cannot maintain chastity, but can keep vows, you can take certain layperson's vows that last an entire lifetime, or other layperson's vows that last for only a day. We find many similarities in the monastic life in all religions. Simplicity, devotion through prayer or meditation, and service to others. Christian clergy are especially committed to service in the fields of education, health, and welfare, and Buddhist monastics have much to learn from these Christian traditions. Practice of the morality of individual liberation, whether lay or monastic, leads to contentment. For example, monastics adhere to a limited diet, a small breakfast and then lunch with nothing after that. They have no right to demand, "I want this food or that food." Whatever they are offered on daily rounds of begging, they must accept. Thus, Buddhist monastics are not necessarily vegetarian. Whatever they get, they will eat. That is the training of contentment regarding food. Such contentment alleviates anxiety about getting this or that kind of food. Lay people can emulate this practice by not insisting on special foods. Even if you are rich, you actually cannot consume much more than poor people, except to your own detriment. Both rich and poor have the same stomach. With regard to clothing, monks and nuns are limited to only one set of robes. To own more than one, he or she must get the blessing of another monastic, keeping in mind that the extra robe also belongs to the other person. We cannot wear expensive clothing. Prior to the communist Chinese invasion, monks and nuns sometimes wore luxurious clothes, which amounted to corruption and self-deception. In a way, we could say that the communist Chinese have been kind to us by destroying these corruptions. This limitation in dress is the practice of contentment regarding clothes. Lay people can adopt a similar practice through moderation in dress. The same is true for adornments. Wearing more than one ring on each finger is certainly too much. It is a mistake to think that it is really worthwhile to spend more on food, clothing, and adornments just because you have more money. Rather, spend more on health and education for poor people. This is not forced socialism, but voluntary compassion. Also, it is essential for monastics to be satisfied with adequate shelter. An elaborate home is not allowed. This is called contentment with regard to shelter. Lay people can adapt this practice by reducing the never-ending quest for a better home and for the furniture and decorations in it. Examine your attitudes toward food, clothes, and shelter. By reducing expectations, you will promote contentment. The extra energy which is released should be devoted to meditation and to achieve cessation of problems, corresponding to the fourth and third noble truths. In this way, the three types of contentment are the basis, and the resulting action is called liking meditation and abandonment. We should be contented in material areas, for those are bound by limitation. But we should not be contented with regard to the spiritual, which can be extended limitlessly. Though it is true that a discontented person who owned the whole world might purchase a tourist center on the moon, that person's life is limited, and even the amount that can be owned is limited. It is better right from the beginning to be contented. However, with regard to compassion and altruism, there is no limit, and thus we should not be content with the degree that we have. We are just the opposite. In the spiritual field, we are content with slight amounts of practice and progress. But materially, we always want more and more. It should be the other way around. Everyone needs to practice this, whether lay or monastic. Practicing the morality of individual liberation is also helpful in increasing mindfulness and introspection. If a monastic is about to commit certain acts, even in a dream, he or she realizes, "I'm a monk. I'm a nun. I should not act in this way. Mindfulness comes from a highly developed awareness of your physical and verbal actions, which carries over into dream time. If you pay close attention to your conduct when eating, coming and going, sitting and standing, and so forth, then a strong condition of mindfulness will take hold. The practice of the morality of individual liberation also fosters tolerance and patience. Buddha said that patience is the highest form of asceticism, and through it one can reach nirvana. For monks and nuns, there are four qualities of patience and tolerance to maintain. If someone pushes you around, you should be tolerant, patient. If someone shows you anger, you should not respond with anger. If someone hits you, you should not strike back. If someone embarrasses and insults you, you should not answer back. These practices increase patience. A person who has left the householder's life but hurts someone else is not engaged in proper activity. There are even stories of monks in Tibet who have gone to war. They threw themselves into battle, despite Buddha's repeated teaching that to harm anyone else is certainly not virtuous for a monk or nun. Spiritual practice is not about externals, food, clothes, or the like. Spiritual practice takes place in our hearts, in our minds. True change is within. Leave the outside as it is. If your behavior truly reflects an improved mind and heart, that is fine. However, if you are just making a show of your spiritual accomplishments in order to get money, for example, that is hypocrisy. Practicing Buddhism means transforming your attitude. Monastic practices can be incorporated into a layperson's life through a strong, conscious wish to refrain from harming others physically or verbally. This requires patience that will withstand physical and verbal attack. A gradual approach is far better than trying to jump too high too soon. Otherwise, there is great risk and danger. For the time being, contribute to society and practice the teachings. Once you reach a certain degree of experience, you can practice with greater force if you become a monastic. These practices fit together step by step. Usually my advice for beginners is to be patient. Have fewer expectations of yourself. It is most important to be an honest citizen, a good member of the human community. Whether or not you understand profound ideas, it is important to be a good person wherever you are right now. You should not neglect a greater purpose for the sake of a smaller one. Consider both the present and the long term, in the same way that temporary economic gains should be considered in relation to long-term environmental needs. I like to say that the essence of the Buddha's teaching can be found in two sayings. If possible, you should help others. If that is not possible, at least you should do no harm. Refraining from harming others is the essence of the initial stage of living the teachings of morality. Summary for daily practice. Notice your attachments to food, clothing, and shelter, and adapt monastic practices of contentment to a layperson's life. Be satisfied with adequate food, clothing, and shelter. Use the additional free time for meditation, so that you can overcome more problems. Develop a strong desire to refrain from harming others, either physically or verbally, no matter whether you are embarrassed, insulted, reviled, pushed, or hit.